And welcome once again to EWTN's Bookmark. I'm Doug Keck, your host. Our guest author is Kenneth Craycraft. His book is Citizens Yet Strangers, Living Authentically Catholic in a Divided America, published by our friends over at Our Sunday Visitor, naturally available through the EWTN Religious Catalog, EWTNRC.com for all things Catholic. Welcome, Kenneth.
Thank you, Doug. Nice to be with you.
EWTN's Bookmark Show. People would have seen when you were on with Father Mitch kind of talking about the same kind of a topic, citizens yet strangers. Well, what are they then?
Yeah, well, that's a good question to begin with. The title of the book actually was not my own. It came from the publisher.
Okay.
I was going to call it something else. Neither left nor right.
Okay.
Why Catholic Moral Theology Transcends Politics. But they suggested Citizens Yet Strangers, which comes from a letter that I discuss, and a late first century, early second century apologetic letter called the Epistle to Diognetus,
right.
In which
one wasn't written by St. Paul.
No, that's right. But in which the author discusses the predicament of mm-hmm. the Christian in the Roman Empire. And the book is remarkably prescient in the way that we live today as Christians in a foreign politics, you might say, not an empire, but
right.
a republic.
Right.
And he said, you know, we are citizens yet strangers. And what he meant by that is that Christians can live under any kind of politics. They can speak any language, wear any clothes, have any customs, obviously, that mm-hmm. wouldn't contradict Catholic morality. But they're also strangers everywhere
right.
because their obedience and their commitments are chastened and qualified by their commitments to the gospel.
Well, I think you talk about it in the book, but wasn't that some of the concerns that people in the United States had about the loyalty of Catholics?
It was, and that's exactly what drives, I think, a lot of Catholics to find themselves really conflicted about what it means to be an American and to be a Catholic, because we want to be liked, as I say in the book, and we want to be, you know, good citizens, and we want to be good, at what I prefer, civic friends.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to do that, we find ourselves forming the way that we think about public policy and public life and morality
mm-hmm.
in general, sometimes more in terms of what it means to be a good American than what it means to be a good Catholic. And I want to make it clear, and I make it clear in the book, I'm not casting aspersions.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm saying is that there's a way in which we are affected by the moral theories that undergird the founding of America that we need to be aware of so that
right.
we can question when there's a
right.
tension with
because
our own
faith.
Because
they are impacting on us.
Absolutely.
You
yeah.
say here, rapidly changing social norms, why we Catholics are so ill-equipped to meet these social challenges or even to articulate a response to them. You say the purpose of the book is to address the precarious situation as a symptom of the same basic problem, namely that we have abandoned or forgotten the moral language of Catholicism, replaced it with the moral dialect, and leads inevitably to failure and frustration. So what have we replaced it with?
What we've replaced it with is a language of individual morality, privatized morality, individualism, autonomy, and a regime of individual rights that is not a part of the Catholic moral tradition, but is rather a part of the modern liberal moral tradition. Now, I want to say, just because something doesn't come specifically from the Catholic tradition doesn't mean that it's not true
right.
and that it cannot be accepted.
Right. And you also want to define the word liberal.
Yes. And so what I mean by liberal or liberalism is not what the typical man on the street means as the left side of the American political spectrum identified typically with the Democrat Party. By liberal, I mean the basic moral foundation that informs the very genius of the American system. So the way that I use the term liberal throughout the book, without any exceptions, is to identify, would encompass everyone from the far right of the Republican Party to the far left of the Democrat Party, because they both begin with the same basic moral anthropology, what I call a moral anthropology, and that's a view of the human person in which morality is autonomous and privatized, and which is based upon the most fundamental moral category of individual possessive rights, which I identify as claims that we have against one
right.
another. And those things, because that's what we learn as Americans, even Catholics growing up in good, pious Catholic homes, because we learn those things as self-evidently true, and I question whether those things are true,
mm-hmm.
but we learn them as self-evidently true, and then we try to figure out how that fits with being a Catholic. Or, what's worse, is that we don't try to figure out how it fits with being a Catholic, and we gradually allow our Catholicism to be subsumed under those theories.
And you talk about calling us liberal Protestants here in the
Yes.
United States. And of course, the United States was founded basically as a Protestant country. So what do you mean when you use those terms?
By liberal, I mean, well, first of all, to answer the question, then come back and fill it out. I use liberal and Protestant as the political and religious terms that basically express the same moral anthropology. Mm-hmm. So again, for liberalism, it's privatized morality and autonomy and individualism. The Protestant part is primarily that plus the church as a voluntary society, one voluntary society among others. And again, a definition is important. By voluntary society, I don't mean that it's an organization that you're free to join or not to join as an active moral agency.
Okay.
Rather, what I mean by that is the Protestant notion of the church as a voluntary society is that the church is actually created by the wills of its members. Not simply that we join them as an act of voluntas, but that church is created as an act of voluntas. And that goes to the heart of, you know, early 16th century Protestant Reformation, or mm-hmm. so-called a revolution with Martin Luther, because that was the genius, one of the geniuses of this of that movement are the solas, one of which is sola fide, which means that, and sola scriptura, mm-hmm. which means that all of which really means sola me, right? Mm-hmm. That I make the decisions. And so in America, we have, these are the, as you say, it's a Protestant founding and it's a liberal founding. So it's privatized morality, it's the church as a voluntary institution. What I worry about, Doug, mm-hmm. in terms of we Catholics, is that we carry those two mentalities into our own faith such that gradually we see morality is privatized, and the church is a voluntary institution. And I think that you see this when you see Catholics, you know, you see Catholics who don't go to Mass at all, but still identify as
sort
Catholics.
Cafeteria Catholicism et al.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. But even Mass-going Catholics who even might, you know, basically adhere to the church's moral teaching, don't do it because the church mm-hmm. teaches it, but rather because they've decided that it's the right thing to do.
Right.
And I call for us to kind of try to reconfigure the way that we understand the moral foundations of the way we reason.
And you mentioned it in the book, but, you know, a conscience is king, isn't it?
Yeah, conscience
is king.
If
I think about what the church has to say, but I come to my own conclusion because
right.
Newman said, that's what I should do, no?
And that's a misapplication of what Newman said, of course, as you know, because what we have to understand is that, and Newman got this from Aquinas, is that indeed it is the case that it's always evil to will against an erring conscience. That's true. We can't, because if we have an erring conscience and we reason against it, then we're deliberately intending to do what conscience tells us is evil, which itself is an act of evil. But that doesn't mean that conscience is king. It only means that we have an obligation to develop our conscience and form our conscience according to the truth about the human person. And what I tell my students, Doug, is that we need to think of conscience not as the source of morality, mm-hmm. but rather as the depository of morality. And in the American context, conscience is the source of morality. It springs from it, rather than conscience being the depository of the moral life. And so we have a prior obligation to form our conscience in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
And even Aquinas, after he said that to will against evil, erring conscience is evil, in the very next article, he mm-hmm. says, but that doesn't excuse us because we have the general obligation to form our conscience according to the truth about the human person. That's the part that American liberal Protestantism rejects, because conscience itself is sovereign, and therefore the only judgment about the morality of an action is to the extent to which it is an exercise of sovereign conscience.
Mm.
Doesn't matter what the choice is, it only matters that it was an exercise of sovereign conscience. And how often do we see Catholics say similar things to that?
Well, let me ask you too, because someone would say, well, as a Catholic, I have my belief system, I follow the church and I do, but I can't impose these things on a secular society. These people aren't Catholic.
Yeah.
So where do I get off telling them what to do?
And I don't suggest that we should tell them what to do.
Mm-hmm.
I don't suggest that we should look at our public lives primarily as trying to change people's minds to the to the policy positions that we would advocate. Rather, I think that our obligation as a Catholics is to be consistent disciples ourselves mm-hmm. and consistent witnesses of the distinctly Catholic way of understanding the world, and therefore a witness to a better way. Not trying to change people's minds by public policy. No, I don't believe people become converted by issues. Mm-hmm. I think they become converted by being convinced of the truth of the faith,
right.
and then the issues follow. So, and as I'm very fond of saying, the Great Commission was not is not go out and convince everybody that abortion is wrong or mm-hmm. euthanasia is wrong or contraception is wrong. The Great Commission is go out and make disciples,
right.
and we do that by consistent.
Disciples then understand what the truth is.
Exactly, and they witness to that truth in society.
Right.
But the point there is that we're not driven by a need, a felt desire to change society, but rather felt a desire and need to be better disciples and better witnesses of the truth. Now, if we're not able to articulate what that means, which is one of the mm-hmm. gravamen of the book, then that's a problem. So I'm calling us to try to reinvigorate our own Catholic language so we can articulate what it means to be a disciple.
Right. I was going to ask you about that because you're bringing that up several times about we can't talk to each other. Truly Catholic understanding of human person. Americans have largely been informed by the liberal story. While contemporary debates do seem to be especially contentious, the problems that underlie them are inherent in the very nature of Catholic faith and practice.
Mm-hmm.
What is it about the way we think or speak that we're missing?
Well, we do have a sovereign, which under which the that is the sovereignty of God, under which the national sovereignty works, mm-hmm. and from which it gets its, whether it acknowledges that or not, and from which it gets its authority. And so we have to have a chastened understanding of what it means even to be a good citizen, mm-hmm. because that citizenship is always chastened and qualified by our prior commitment to the gospel. And in terms of how we articulate that in public life, we need to learn to, I think, re-articulate a Catholic vision of the moral life such that it's understood mm-hmm. that while we are obedient as good civic friends, our obedience, as the Epistle to Diognetus puts it, is founded upon something other than the laws of the regime.
Well, do you think, is it harder today because in some
yes.
ways society has shifted away? There used to be a much more of a parallelism to
yes.
that kind of faith perspective, at least whether it was Protestant or Catholic, and kind of like a civic duty?
I believe that is the case, Doug. Uh-huh. I believe that very much, and I think you're really hitting on something that's very important, is that some of the pushback that I get on the book or other articles I've written that anticipate the book is that, well, you know, the U.S., the founders talked about things like common, they use the term common good and so forth. Mm-hmm. And my point is, my response is that, well, we can only live on that pre-modern capital for so long. And anybody who understands, you know, finances understands that you can't spend capital. And if you spend the capital, eventually you're going to go broke.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what we've been doing is spending Catholic capital for 250 years, and now we're starting to go broke. And because we've been spending the capital on a language that is not our language mm-hmm. and on a way of thinking about morality that is not our way of thinking about morality.
Well, do you think also just the idea in some ways in being more inviting, a lot of people have been led to believe that
yes.
through God's all-merciful forgiveness that it really doesn't matter that much what you particularly do, whether you go to Mass or not.
Yeah.
And certainly, you know, in the society, you don't want to judge anybody.
Yeah.
And so...
And that's part of that voluntarism,
you know,
and that
and
sovereignty
in the therapeutic
conscience.
World we
yes.
live in today where we won't want anybody to feel bad.
Right, right. The only mandate is that you don't offend. Right,
right. Exactly. You say we must begin to recover a moral language that is formed by Catholic moral doctrine rather than by liberal political theory. What is the major moral doctrine did you think we're missing out on?
Well, I think I would answer that as four major moral doctrines.
Okay. And those are the pillars.
Those
you
are
talk
the pillars.
About?
Yeah, okay. The pillars of Catholic social doctrine. And I think it's important, Doug, to emphasize that when we started talking about this book and the title of the book, and as I said, they rejected my title. But even before that, we mm-hmm. talked about having social doctrine in the title. And the reason we didn't do that is because there's a certain kind of Catholic reader who would not even pick up the book if it has social doctrine
right.
in the title.
Mm-hmm.
And that's precisely the Catholic that we want to reach.
Mm-hmm.
So we snuck it in. The discussion of social doctrine. And that is, of course, the dignity of the human person, mm-hmm. of all human persons, as made in the image and likeness of God, subsidiarity as the first, as the doctrine of how we help and on what level we help, mm-hmm. solidarity, which means that, as I put it, we're all in this together, and of course, the common good toward which all those other pillars tend. And I would say that if we take that as a fourfold doctrine, then we could call it one doctrine. But I, you know, as you know, I call it, I call call it the four pillars of Catholic social doctrine. And I think that's a helpful way of thinking about the moral life that doesn't have any, doesn't, you don't need to talk about individualism, you don't talk about rights, you don't talk about my private conscience, but all of those things have to do with the basic understanding of who the human person properly is, and therefore what kind of society is consistent with what the human person is. And that's why I start with Genesis, the creation accounts, because I think they teach us a lot about the human person.
Right, who's Emily and Sarah, and why should we care?
Emily and Sarah are two fictional characters from a favorite series of novels of mine called the Aubrey Machen series by Patrick O'Brien. Mm-hmm. And Emily and Sarah are two orphans that were found when, and these are early 19th century tales of Captain English ship's captain, and his physician. And they were in the far, they're in the South Sea Islands, and they came upon an island, and in the novel is called Sweeting's Island. It's fictional. But there were two young girls, maybe ages 4 and 6, and everyone else had died, presumably from smallpox. Mm-hmm. And when they were found, they spoke their native language. Well, Dr. Maturin took them on board because they couldn't leave them on the island. Mm-hmm. And they found that, and then they sailed back to England, which took many months. And they found that as these young girls were sailing back to England, they started to pick up the English of the forecastle, but also the English of the midship. So they picked up two distinct dialects of English, but what gradually happened is that they stopped speaking their own language. Mm-hmm. And that led the ship's crew to speculate whether you can forget your own language. And I just love this metaphor, or the metaphorical power that it gives to me from my book, because they ask, can you forget your own language? Can you forget the syntaxes and grammars and vocabularies of your own language? Because you're only thinking and speaking in another language. And here are these 4 and 6 year old girls, and that's exactly what happened. So they stopped speaking their own language except for rote recitation when they played. Mm-hmm. And I suggest that that's exactly a perfect metaphor for what's happened to Catholics in America, is that we've learned to speak in the dialects, certain American dialects, but in the process, we have gradually forgotten the Catholic dialect, but we don't understand that we're actually speaking a different language. We don't understand that we've forgotten Catholic. We just think that we're speaking Catholic when we're not. And Emily and Sarah are my poster children for that in the book.
Okay. Well, you say two people may use a common term, like justice, for example, and mean very different things, and that's what you're relating to.
Exactly right. So if somebody uses the term justice, some people might think of justice as fairness. Some people might think of justice as individual equality. Neither of those are Catholic definitions of justice. The Catholic definition of justice
what's
is
fair
to
anyway.
Render...
Yeah,
what's fair
what,
anyway.
What's fair
yeah.
anyway.
Right. What's fair and what's equal anyway.
Right,
the
right.
Catholic definition of justice is to render another his due. Very different from any theory of justice that you'll see in American politics. Mm-hmm. Dignity is the same way. You know, the interesting thing about dignity, one person will use the term dignity to defend euthanasia and assisted physician-assisted suicide, whereas our understanding of dignity necessarily and absolutely precludes physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia. So once again, we have two people who might be using the same language, but mean something completely different by it.
Well, you say here in a section as well under why the common good is neither common or good. Catholicism understands freedom in its full sense to be something that is achieved through moral choices ordered toward the good.
Yeah.
Isn't that what everybody thinks?
Everybody orders their choices toward the good, but there's a difference between a good, which is the good common to all human persons, and the good which is idiosyncratic to every person. And this gets us right, of course, to the classic, Augustine's classic treatise on the city of God, So we're either formed by the love of God, which calls all of us to be ordered in the same way, or we're ordered toward self, which means that we're all ordered in a billion different ways. Mm-hmm. One is the way of eternal life, as St. Augustine put it, one is the way of perdition. So in the one sense, it's absolutely true. Everyone reasons morally in a way that they reason toward the good, that they conceive of as the good. The difference is, do we posit a good that is good rooted in the very nature of things because we're created by God, or is the good whatever we decide it is as autonomous moral agents? And by autonomous, I don't simply mean that we have moral agency, free moral agency, but rather that we make the law up as we go along. Mm-hmm. We are the source of law, going back to our discussion of conscience.
Okay. And that's where you talk about things like my body, my choice, and
yes.
Use the term pro-choice. And you quote John Paul, every generation of Americans needs to know that freedom consists not in doing what we like, but in having the right to do what we ought, which is, you know, it's such an obviously positive statement. But we live in a world where people's ideas of freedom has to do with that I can do whatever I want to do.
Right.
Especially with no repercussions, apparently.
Absolutely. And it's interesting that John Paul gave that speech in the U.S., in Baltimore.
Right.
Yeah, so what happens is that the way I like to explain it, and I do in the book, is that the freedom to choose between A and B is the necessary precondition for a moral action, but it's not the sufficient condition for a good moral action. So we have to be free to choose, otherwise our action has no moral content. But we have to choose correctly for our actions to have good moral content. And that's the point that he's making in that speech.
Right.
We in America, the American language of morality, says that we end our discussion of the morality of the action by the relative freedom by which we make it. The more free, the more moral. The less free, the less moral.
Mm-hmm.
The object of the action has no bearing on the analysis. Whereas, of course, the Catholic understanding is that you begin with the object and then discuss how freedom is used properly or improperly.
Do you think Catholics also kind of have an idea that something, maybe it's broader than that, just the idea, if it's legal, it must be moral?
There is a sense in that. There's a sense in which, and it's the same, it's interesting you would say that, because it's the same person who oftentimes will say you can't legislate morality.
Right, absolutely.
Which is a complete contradiction.
Right.
But yeah, there is that mentality that if it's legal to do it, it's moral to do it. And that tells us that law is a teacher. And politics is a teacher too, but not always a good teacher. And that is very much a part of the American idea.
And you put a lot of questions that people have to think about. You say this is not to suggest that Catholics withdraw from political life, to resist partisan identification is not to abdicate our civic responsibility. We should be more cautious about the two tendencies. First, to reduce the mandate for civic friendship to one for political activity. Second, to reduce political activity to partisan loyalty. Then what should we be doing?
Yeah, and that one of the questions that I get that question a lot, and the answer is subtle, but I think it's important, and that is, I don't believe that, I think that we have to understand, going back to something I said earlier, that the question of what we should do should not be driven by how what we do will change society, but rather how what we do will reflect Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And those are not necessarily the same things. Now, by reflecting Christ, by being good disciples, and by being people who are witnesses to the gospel, that will always have a salutary effect on society. But we shouldn't see it as our mandate to change society, because the reason that I say that is because if we see it as our mandate to change society, we have a felt need to make those changes in terms that society will already accept. And that's the whole point. They won't, because we're speaking a language, or should be speaking a language, that is different, that is distinct. Now, it's a language that others can accept and understand if they listen in good faith, but also if they observe our own consistent witness to the gospel. And that's the first thing that we need to do, is be better, consistent witnesses to the gospel, not just in what we do, but also in how we speak.
You talk about the four inherent dignity, solidarity, subsidiarity, the common good, and you talk about, rather than affirm solidarity with his brother, you talk about Cain separates himself from Abel, and the natural result of this rejection of solidarity is Cain's own banishment from the community. You go on to say, when solidarity is denied or compromised, alienation follows.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that what we're seeing in society
today? I think we
are
seeing this, absolutely. I think that we're seeing this. And it's no contradiction to say that we are built on radical individualism and to say that we're becoming tribalistic. And in fact, not only is it not contradictory, one follows the other, because we take our radical individualism and we form tribes around that, but those tribes themselves are expressions.
Even though it sounds counterintuitive.
Right, it sounds counterintuitive, but I don't think that it is, because those tribes themselves are groups of people who are all alienated from one another.
Mm.
You know, I sometimes jokingly said that, or query whether the worst crime that Abel committed was killing his brother or alienating himself from his brother by the deception that he must have used to get him into the field. And I suggest that there's a way in which the greater harm that was done was the alienation of Cain from Abel, even from killing Cain and Abel. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't mean that, you know, lying is worse than murder, but I do suggest that the story in Genesis chapter 4 really tells us something very, very much deeper than simply the problem of murder. And that's illustrated when he asks the rhetorical question of God, am I my brother's keeper? Right. Which, of course, was not a question at all. It was an assertion that he's not his brother's keeper.
Right.
And that is that fundamental division and alienation of brother from brother. And it's a denial of one of those pillars of Catholic social doctrine of solidarity.
You said, when I criticize the use of rights language, I'm often asked what I would replace this language with for the protection of the individual freedom. Is not liberty an authentic value?
Yeah. Liberty is an authentic value, but it's liberty is a residual value. The right, what is right precedes the choice. The choice doesn't precede the right. Mm-hmm. So in other words, while liberty is a value, it's not the ultimate value. It isn't what we should never think of freedom as being the end of our moral action, but rather some good, the good as the end of a moral action to which we must be free mm-hmm. in order to obtain and in order to pursue. So I replace individual rights with dignity, with obligation, with duties toward one another that are rooted in the natural solidarity of the human person.
You say here, the moral life is not simply about making the right choice or choosing the right moral object. Rather, Catholic moral theology is concerned with becoming the right kind of person. Well, who defines what that is?
Well, that's why we have a church, right? Okay. The church defines what that is, and we can't be bashful about that. We can't be shy about our understanding that we have the deposit of faith, that the church is not an expert on economics or family policy. Well,
regardless of what some people say,
exactly. But the church is an expert on the human person, right. And that's where the depository of truth is, guided by the magisterium, aided by theologians. Obviously guided by the Holy Spirit and the sensus fidelium, that's where the truth lies. And we have to affirm that's our source of truth, and that's the source of what it is we should and shouldn't be doing.
Just before we go, one of the things you kind of are focused on here is the idea of the family,
yes,
the birth rate, and things
yeah.
like that. Why mm-hmm. is that important in your mind?
Well, we're seeing how important it is right now, aren't we, when we see study after study that shows that we're in a drastic decline and we're not even replacing ourselves.
Oh, you mean it's not a population explosion
Yeah,
anymore?
There's no population explosion, and there never was.
Anybody could tell Paul Ehrlich?
Paul Ehrlich, and Paul Ehrlich is still spewing the same stuff
yeah,
after 50 years.
He's still
talking after 50
right,
years.
Yeah.
Well, what we see is we see a public policy disaster on the horizon when people like you and me are getting older, and there's nobody coming along to foot the bill of
right.
people getting older. We
right.
see housing. We see in Japan and China, it's even worse than it is here.
Empty houses.
Amazing. Yeah, and it's going to start happening here
right.
as well because we're not replacing ourselves. So yeah,
right.
the family as the first social society, family of solidarity,
right.
we must reaffirm, because as St. John Paul II said, if the family goes, it all goes.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Kenneth Craycraft, for your fine book, Citizens Yet Strangers, Living Authentically Catholic in a Divided America. Unfortunately, it is. This is published by OSV, available through the EWTN Religious Catalog, EWTNRC.com, all things Catholic. Check it out. I'm Doug Keck. Thanks for joining us right here on EWTN's Bookmark. We shall see you next time.